I happen to be on the ethics committee of our local hospital. And it must have been 6 months ago or so in which, you know, I sat and listened to a conversation with nurses, hospital administrators, social workers, and physicians, in which what was being talked about was, I suppose I could have figured out that this could possibly happen in medical caregiving, but what was being talked about are a number of conflicts which had been faced by physicians in the hospital, and the whole point of the conversation was to develop, talk about what kind of policies should we have when these kind of things come up. And I sat and listened to this, and as I explained it to you, I said, well, yeah, but why should you be surprised that there would be those kind of conflicts? I'll tell you in a minute why I was sort of taken by this. But the kind of conflicts that were being talked about were situations in which a patient was, as it were, staring death in the face. I mean, this is an end-of-life patient. And the patient, if he or she is conscious, or some surrogate or proxy spokesperson who speaks on behalf of an incompetent patient, was demanding that certain forms of treatment be given to the patient, and the conflict got generated when the physician said, but if we render this treatment, if we administer it, it's going to be futile. It won't have any therapeutic benefit. And then we had these standoffs saying, well, how do you know it won't work? It's my life. It's my father's life. And I want everything done. I mean, what is your job as a physician except to be my assistant, to help us? What are you, jumping ship? What do you mean? I can't give it because I think it's going to be futile. Well, wait a minute. Now, as I heard these tales, it didn't surprise me that such situations could arise. But what was really interesting from my perspective is that I said, wow, have we entered a new moment in medicine? Because, you know, all of you in this room can remember that a couple of decades ago, we were fighting on another front. We were fighting on for things like the passage of so-called living wills, durable power terms for healthcare. What was the issue at this time? Well, this was an outcry from patientdom across the United States saying, look, when we're under the care of a physician who is committed to this Hippocratic tradition, you know, patient presents himself, doctor knows best, here's what we're going to do, what ends up happening to us is that these doggone doctors who are so committed, I mean, the last thing that they can stand is to lose a patient, to have a patient die, you know, just a failure, you know. What they end up doing is they keep subjecting end-of-life patients to more and more heroic treatments, on and on, and it's as if patients at large rose up and said, enough, enough. We're not going to take this anymore. We want to control what is done to us. We want to call the shots with respect to it. And this, then, is the advent of a whole new moment, sort of the moment of change up from, what shall I say, medical paternalism, you do what I say, I'm doctor, here's what we need to do, versus patient's call. It's my life under treatment, and I want to be able to control it. You tell me what the options are, and I shall make the final decision. The whole upshot with living wills and so forth is explainable on the ground of certain patients who don't want rendered to them a whole bunch of treatments and so forth, which the medical community seems to feel as though they have to render. But now look what we got. It seems as though we've turned on the other side here. Now you got the medical community. It seems like we changed places. Now you got the medical community saying, we're being hit up with requests from patients which we think are unreasonable. Patients or their surrogates are demanding treatment at the end of life, which we have good medical grounds good clinical medical grounds for saying are going to be of no avail. And yet, they're not going to take our word for it. In some cases, they say, I want it. I want it. Everything must be done because the human life is at stake. And now you have the medical community saying, oh, no, hold it. The most high-profile case of this sort occurred about 40 miles away from my campus at a Minneapolis hospital about 4 years ago when there was a woman by the name of Helga Wangley. Now, she was in her late 70s, and she had, I think, suffered a stroke and probably even had suffered anoxia, brain without oxygen for more than 4 minutes and so forth. And she was entirely ventilator dependent. She was in what medical people call a persistent vegetative state. And all the neurologists and everything said she's never going to regain consciousness. There's no cells left in the cerebral cortex to be conscious with anymore, right? Got a great brain stem, you know, I mean, it's controlling visceral functions and so forth, but I mean, she can make spontaneous respiratory effort, okay? So to the extent she can do that, she's not big D dead according to law, all right? And so you have to hook her up to a ventilator, but the considered judgment of all the attending physicians was that she's ventilator dependent. But their judgment was she's never going to regain consciousness. She never will. And the question is, why are we keeping her on a ventilator? Why are we artificially feeding and hydrating her? And Steve Miles, who was one of the attending neurologists, said, look, this is a classic case in the rendering of futile medical treatment. And it's costing dollars, ladies and gentlemen. It's costing resources. And so he petitioned Helga's husband, who happened to be an attorney, a retired attorney, to give consent to, you know, take her off the ventilator and to remove feeding and hydrating tubes and so forth, to try to persuade him of the sanity of this, because in his view, there was no hope for Helga. There is no hope. She'll never gain consciousness. And the surprise that Steve Miles got is that I forget what his name was. Mr. Wangley ended up saying, listen, if Helga could speak for herself, she would tell you what I'm telling you right now, that we put our faith in God and not in man. She would tell you, if she were capable of being consulted, that she wants everything done. So you keep her on that ventilator. You keep her on it, because that's what she would want. Miles says, but it's not going to go anywhere. Nothing's going to happen. They went to court over this, and the court decided that Mr. Wangley wins because, you know, this right to control your own medical treatment not only confers on you a right to withdraw from certain medical treatment that people may want to give to you, it not only gives you that right, that's what living wills is all about, but it also gives you the right to demand that treatment continue. I mean, it's a two-edged sword. That right to control medical treatment has got two sides. So the hospital lost. Helga eventually died from something or other. I mean, and the case is moot. But this is really interesting. Now, this is the beginning of a whole group of cases having to do with the other side of the coin. Patients challenging physicians or their surrogates to render treatment which the medical community thinks is an excellent reason for believing is going to be futile if it's rendered. And they don't think that they've got a moral obligation as physicians to kowtow to even demands to do this. And so we have a real interesting face-off now going here. And it's in this particular issue that I'd like to have us take a look at today, because I found, you know, since 6 months ago when this sort of exploded in my face in the Ethics Committee meeting, that this is a very interesting debate. It's much more complex than at first sight it would appear, and it appears to set the medical community and a whole bunch of standards over against what you might call the rights of patient autonomy, control their own medical treatment, and so we have a real titanic struggle now between these two points of view concerning the care of patients. And it was my hope that what we can do today is talk about what the complexities of this thing is, and then talk about how we're going to deal with this on maybe a local level or even a public policy level.
I'm just curious, who was paying for all this?
Interesting. Wangley had, I mean, Helga was on Medicare because she was Medicare eligible, okay. But then they had one of these Medigap policies like most of us have, you know, Blue Cross that picks up what Medicare will not do. And fortunately, the policy was quite good. The policy said it would pay. So if you ask who pays, well, I guess with Blue Cross or whatever, yeah. One of these Medigap policies.
I know in a lot of cases, in much less lower levels of
payment, well, the plot begins to thicken or sicken, you know, by the time we get to that. Okay, here's the way I would like to prime the pump for what I think might be some good salutary discussion. I'd like to have us exposed to both sides in this particular debate. See if we can hit up the arguments that seem to be goodies, you know, on both sides. And we're very fortunate to help us in this debate today, two people. One is Dr. Mervyn Dweeby, who is the executive director of the Society of American Physicians, and he will give the physician's point of view. We're also have the honor of having with us today Mr. Hobart Quimby, who is the president-elect of the Society for Patients' Rights. So the first part I'd like to present the medical community's point of view is Dr. Mervyn Dweeby. You want to tell Dr. Dweeby to come on in?
Okay.
Is he? Did you find him?
Your help.
Oh, excuse me.
I'll be right back.
He needs your help.
Mr. Cameron, I shouldn't have come here.
You shouldn't have come?
I've been through all this crap.
So what? We all have.
And I told everybody, if you got to put a tube in every orifice I have, forget it.
Well, there's a few I might.
Oh, no.
Good afternoon, I'm Dr. Mervyn Dweeby. I'm executive director of the Society for American Physicians. And remarks I have to offer today are really directed toward vindicating two principal theses, a modest thesis, and then what you might call an immodest one, an industrial strength thesis. But here are the theses I want to defend. Number one, I maintain that physicians who are beholden to the goals of medicine have no obligation to administer treatment that they regard to be futile, even if the patient requests it. Now let me reframe this. I'm saying that physicians beholden to the goals of medicine have a right to refuse requests for futile medical treatment by patients or their surgeons. But then I have a more immodest thesis, a more strident one to defend. I want to then argue that physicians beholden to the special moral duties that attach to the practice of medicine have an implied positive moral duty to refuse requests for futile medical treatment by patients. Now, whether the claim is that physicians have got a right to refuse or a positive duty to refuse, all of this I'm going to defend on the ground that they have this right, they have this duty, on the grounds of preserving the integrity of the medical profession. Now, before we get started, on my argument for these two theses, we have to get some definitional matters addressed. What do we mean by a futile medical procedure? I mean, how would you know one if you ran into one? I mean, this is a definitional issue. I propose the following definition of medical futility. A therapeutic medical procedure is futile when there is the unacceptable likelihood that it will produce any therapeutic benefit for the patient. I propose this definition. You can't go to Merriam-Webster and get a definition, so I'm giving you one as something to work with. Now, let's just take a look at some of the pieces of this proposed definition. I'm isolating, among all the category of medical treatments, therapeutic medical procedures. Now, I'm roughly dividing the world of medical procedures into two types, just for the sake of simplicity. Therapeutic procedures are ones whose goal, intent, end in view is to either cure or to rehabilitate, that is to bring back some semblance of acceptable health a patient. Now, the other class of treatments, I'm just lumping everything, wallpapering over some niceties here, I want to call palliative medical procedures. Now, these are procedures whose end in view is simply to keep the patient comfortable, collectively called comfort care. The end in view is not to cure, it's not to rehabilitate, because comfort care kicks in when there's a general point of view that nothing more can be done and we have to ratchet down to giving palliative care. But this definition I'm giving refers to therapeutic medical procedures. They're ones in which there's an unacceptable likelihood that they will produce any therapeutic benefit for the patient. Let's take a look at another critical term in here. I mean, what do I mean by a therapeutic benefit? Well, first of all, what I mean by a therapeutic benefit is benefit for the whole patient, the patient as a whole. And there's a lot of treatments that we physicians can render to people that can be a benefit to a particular organ, a piece of somebody's body. But this is not what I mean by a benefit. A benefit is going to benefit the whole patient. For example, being attached to an artificial ventilator can obviously be a benefit to assist a patient's lungs. But if the patient is irreversibly comatose or in the final stages of a terminal condition, while that may benefit his or her lungs, it does not benefit the patient as a whole, and I think we've got to keep the whole notion of benefit tied to what is a benefit for the patient as a whole. Moreover, I want to fine-tune this a bit. In the context of this whole patient orientation toward defining benefit, I'm maintaining that an effect of a medical intervention can be a benefit for the whole patient, mind you, only if both of these are fulfilled. First of all, it can only be a benefit for the whole patient if the patient has the capacity to appreciate it. I mean, somebody who's irreversibly comatose or in a persistent vegetative state fails this. If they're never going to regain consciousness, then I'm saying that any treatment rendered is not going to be a benefit to the patient. And secondly, an effect can only be a benefit for the whole patient if this effect of a treatment can enable the patient, at a minimum, to achieve life goals other than, beyond, being completely preoccupied with his or her medical condition and treatment. Now, let me just spell this latter one out here. If there's good medical grounds for saying, if this person receives this treatment, all that's going to happen is we're going to preserve the life of this patient so that what? I mean, what will be the yield of it? If the only thing you can say is going to happen is that, well, we'll keep him or her alive so that he or she will be able to get daily more medical information about their failing condition so that they can make decisions about further treatment given to them for what purpose, so that they can remain conscious to receive more information about how bad they're doing the next day, so that they can make treatment decisions for what purpose, so that they can the next day receive even more information about how they're going downhill. I judge that what you have here is the yield of this treatment is a life which is nothing but preoccupied with one's medical condition. And I don't think that if that's, I think that if that's the only yield, that you don't have a treatment that could be called a benefit to the whole patient. This is my claim.
In other words, if it can't function in any other way.
That the only life goal that they could achieve would just be keeping alive for the sake of monitoring and superintending their medical treatment. I mean, if that's all the treatment's going to give, I claim it's futile. And I haven't got, I either have a right or a positive duty to refuse it if that's all we're going to get for it. Now, a second important concept, I mean, let me just spell this out. If I could reasonably predict on the basis of medical evidence that the only kind of life the patient is going to have if the treatment succeeds, in snare quotes, is going to keep the patient longer a captive of the intensive care unit, I think we got a futile treatment. I mean, this is my judgment. Now, a second important concept in this definition here is that of the unacceptable likelihood that it will produce any therapeutic benefit for the patient. We've been wrestling with the notion of benefit. Let's go what we mean by the notion of an unacceptable likelihood. What do I mean by a likelihood? I mean statistical probability. That's what I mean by likelihood. Probability estimates are, as you all know, extrapolations from past trials or experiments. Right? I mean, this is how we get probability estimates. So what we need to figure out is how we're going to define unacceptable probability. That's what I mean by unacceptable likelihood. But let me hit you up with a little philosophy here, first of all. It's not really highbrow philosophy, but it has direct relevance to the issue we're talking about here. It has to do with what's called inductive inference. Okay? Let me give an example. No matter how many times in the past we have observed some particular event, B, followed by some prior event, A, no matter how many times we've observed that, we can never say that it's absolutely certain that in the future, if A happens, we're going to see B. Can't say that. I don't care how many times you've taken a sodium salt piece of it and with forceps put it in the flame of a Bunsen burner in a lab and found that it burned yellow. I don't care what it got 10,000 times that that's happened. There is no logical guarantee that the next time that you take one of these pieces that and put it in the Bunsen burner flame, it's going to burn yellow. It might burn blue. In other words, past experience does not require or dictate to nature in any way that it's got to do in the future what it's done in the past. But of course, that's all we have to go on, so we can make probability estimates. But let's turn it the other way. It also works the other way around. No matter how many times in the past we've found that some desired outcome did not follow some prior state of affairs, we can't be absolutely certain that the next time this desired outcome will follow. For example, if in times of drought, I've always done a little dervish-like dance in hopes that rain will come. I mean, if rain has never come, any time I've done this dance, it doesn't necessitate that rain will never come if I do this dance. I mean, maybe the next time it will, okay? I mean, we don't know. Now, what is the relevance of all this to this topic that we're talking about? Consider a desperate, a fearful patient who confronts a physician who has judged that some therapeutic intervention would be futile. And the patient, the desperate patient, is saying, "Dr. Dweeby, how do you know it won't work? Do you know it won't work?" I don't big K know it won't work in the sense that cannot be mistaken. No, I don't know that. And the question, all I have is reasonable projections from past experience. Now, this is a worrisome moment in the doctor-patient dialogue, because if I have to confess, "No, I don't know," does this confer on the patient a right then to say, "Well, then do it. Everything must be done"? I mean, Why can't I hope for a miracle? I mean, you already admitted that simply because it's never worked in the past. It might work in the future. It's my life. I don't think anything that follows. I don't think it confers on patients a right to demand this kind of futile medical treatment when the probabilities are low. Of course, I can't say I know what you're desiring won't happen. I can't say that. I mean, the issue of reasonableness. I mean, the central issue that we need to look at in clarifying this notion of unacceptable likelihood are these. I mean, here are the questions. How many times must a treatment fail to be followed by some desired result before we decide that it doesn't work? How many times must a treatment fail before we decide that the odds of its producing a desired result are unacceptable? But that whole thing's got a logical complement. How many times must a treatment be followed by a desired result before we decide that it works? That is, how many times must a desired result follow from a treatment before we say the odds of it producing the desired result are acceptable? Now, I'm telling you people that at the heart of my profession, we talk as physicians all the time about efficacious treatment, treatments which are efficacious. And I'm saying that the logical complement to that is treatment which are futile. I mean, if you're going to have one, you have to have a definition of the other. I mean, the issue dogs relentlessly our profession, and it's not something that you can run away from. Now, please note that the answers to these questions, well, how many times must a treatment be followed by a desired result before we say it works or the odds are acceptable? Contrary-wise, how many times must a treatment not be followed before we say that it doesn't work, that the odds are unacceptable? I want to assure you that the answers to those questions are decisions made by us. They're not discoveries. They're decisions that are made by us. Now, it's quite obvious that the medical community or society at large can decide, if it wants, how to define these notions, unacceptable likelihood, acceptable likelihood. They can choose greater or lesser odds. I mean, it's a matter of decision. But I don't think it follows the fact that where we draw the line is arbitrary, that anything goes. I think that although it's up to us to decide what level of statistical probability attaches to each of these, unacceptable and acceptable, it's our decision, I still think we can grade these decisions along a continuum of more to less reasonable. So let me try you out here. I propose the following definition of unacceptable likelihood of a treatment's producing a desired result. If a treatment has not produced a specific desired result, that is some specific hope for a therapeutic benefit, in the last 100 cases, then almost certainly, listen to that language, it's not going to work if it's tried again. And I propose that as a specific statistical definition of what I mean by unacceptable likelihood. Now, a lot of people think that this whole notion, that the reason, the fundamental reason we're debating this whole notion of futile medical treatment is because everything is dollar-driven. A lot of people frame this whole debate as, look, you got a bunch of managed care organizations out there and so forth that want to turn a dollar in dividends, you know, for the stockholders and so forth. And the standard view is that the whole medical futility debate is driven by money, and the fundamental issue is one of an efficient allocation of scarce medical resources. My claim is that that's an allied issue. It compounds the issue. The fundamental issue, seems to me, that we're wrestling here, with here is rationality in decision making. We can choose longer or shorter odds. here, you know, that I've given. We're free to do this. But I'm telling you, some statistical definition of unacceptable odds must be agreed upon, or frankly, people, we're at risk of sacrificing common sense entirely. I mean, the fundamental issue of what a rationality or reasonableness is not finances, fundamentally. The fundamental issue of one is rationally certified choice, keeping our actions within the bounds of common sense. I mean, for someone like a patient I've been telling you about, to hope for an outcome whose odds are grossly improbable, I think is irrational. And I want to call that kind of hope foolhardy rather than courageous. Hoping for a miracle against odds like this is frankly irrational. The whole business that giving futile treatment for no yield is going to cost a lot of money, it's going to go down the toilet, is another issue. It's linked, but it's not the fundamental issue. Now, these definitional preliminaries considered, let me now embark on a short defense of my first thesis, then we'll go on to the second one. My first thesis was that physicians who are beholden to the goals of medicine have a right to refuse to give futile medical treatment to patients. And I want to say that we can crank out this claim by showing how that right proceeds from the goals of medicine. You ask me, what are the goals of medicine? I think, at least since Hippocrates, the goals of medicine are really two. First goal is to assist nature to restore health. And the second goal is to relieve suffering. I mean, these are the fundamental goals of medicine. Now, how do we get to this right of a physician to refuse to give futile therapy? We need a little time out here. Notice, goal one, to assist nature to restore health. How would you know health if you ran into it? We got another definitional problem here. I mean, I could come up with some fantastically stringent definition of health, an ideal. Health is a state of zero mental or physical pathologies. Zero. And that's health. And everything else. But I think that flies in the face of common sense. I mean, a lot of us here are saddled with certain difficulties, you know, arthritis or an arrhythmic heart or something. But yet we say, oh, well, they're not perfect health, but they're still healthy. Now, what are we trying to get to? I think the common sense definition of health is here. It's a psychophysical condition that permits one to do most of the things within that range of activities that one finds satisfying. Now, this whole definition is common sense because we all know that as we age, that range of activities that we find satisfying is frequently constricted because of the advent of disease, dysfunction, injury. I mean, it just goes with it. So the range of activities that we find satisfying shrinks. But if we define health in this common sense way, you say, well, you know, he or she's healthy because, I mean, she can do most of the things she still wants to do. I mean, I think that's the man on the street view, and indeed the one that we ought to work with. Now, why do I say, then, I mean, how do I bring this down, that the goals of medicine show that a physician has got a right to refuse of futile medical care? Okay? Well, by definition, if you have a futile treatment, I mean, if you have a futile treatment, you've got a treatment in which you want to be able to say as a physician that it's not going to restore health in this common sense notion, namely that it's going to restore a person to some position where he or she can do most of the things within that range of activities they find satisfying. I mean, that's what I'm getting at. And I'm telling you, to get back to the earlier example, if I predict on good clinical grounds that the only benefit for a patient of a proposed treatment is to be able to deliver a state of continuing to exist biologically and consciously so that he or she is the whole 24-hour day is going to be committed to just monitoring their own failing condition. They're going to remain a prisoner of the ICU. then I don't think that that the yield of that treatment is going to restore health in this sense. I mean, a life preoccupied with one's medical condition is not a healthy life, as I've defined it here. Well, let me move to my more immodest conclusion. I've also indicated that physicians who are beholden to the special moral duties which are binding on the medical profession have a derived moral duty, a duty to refuse to give futile medical treatment to patients or surrogates who request it. Well, how can I make this case? What are the special duties attaching to the medical profession? Well, I think duty number one is the duty not to administer treatments that can cause a harm disproportionate to a foreseeable benefit. I think there's another duty that goes with medical practice. It's sort of endemic to medical practice. The duty not to fraudulently represent a body of knowledge. Well, how do these duties generate this derived duty to refuse to accede to people's requests for futile medical treatment? Well, look at it this way. If there's some medical intervention that I have clinical evidence for believing is not going to meet my definition up here, then if this treatment, if rendered, causes harm to the patient in the form of pain, inconvenience, disfigurement, compromised function of some bodily organ, then a harm has been done without a corresponding preponderant benefit, and we have violation of this duty. On the other hand, if I render in the name of therapy, a treatment that I have eminently good clinical evidence, will not meet this definition, that it's not going to yield a positive benefit. If in the name of therapy I go ahead and render it, what am I doing except misrepresenting a whole body of medical knowledge which says it ain't going to work? I'm fraudulently misrepresenting the body of medical knowledge and then fudging duty number two. Now look, in a couple of minutes you're going to hear from my opponent, Society for Patients' Rights, and he's going to start running by you all kinds of things that he thinks patients have gotten rights to because of out of respect for patient autonomy. And let me see if I can head off at the pass some of these objections, which I don't think are going to work. I mean, what you're going to end up hearing probably is Mr. Quimby saying, "Look, I have a right of moral autonomy. And this confers on me the right to control what is done to my own body." And he's probably going to then argue that this right confers on him a right, because he has a right to control what's done to his own body, that this right confers on him a right to receive medical treatment that the medical institution judges to be futile if he wants it. But I think that's going to be a by-the-board argument. Let me give you three reasons for it. What do you mean by patient autonomy? What are autonomy rights? Well, look, the interesting thing about them is that they all have to be negatively formulated. They're all what philosophers call negative rights. I'm going to give an example. The right to life. Well, what is that? Well, isn't it this? It's the right not, listen to how I frame this, it's the right not to have one's life taken or put at risk by the activity of others. What is my right of liberty? An autonomy right. Well, listen to it. Isn't it a right not to be interfered with as I pursue life goals I've set for myself, right? I mean, the autonomy rights are negative because they place obligations on others to butt out in various ways, to leave me alone. I fully concede that patient autonomy rights confer on every patient, now listen to this, a right to refuse certain forms of medical treatment, a right not to be done to by heroic measures. I concede that. What I do not concede is that rights to patient autonomy confer on patients a right to receive on demand medical treatments which are judged by the medical community to be futile. And we need to attend to this, people, because if you think If you think that autonomy rights confer on patients the right to receive these kind of medical treatments on demand, look what you've done to the medical profession. You have turned the medical profession into nothing more than a bunch of people who are expert information givers, whose sole task is simply to tell the patient what the risks and benefits of various therapeutic regimens are, and then it's patient's call, and we'll do anything that you want, right? I mean, that's all our duty, is to just give you the info, and it's patient's call. I mean, it turns a blind eye toward the fact that medicine is a profession. We've decided upon certain rules, I mean, that we have certain goals, certain moral rules which define our practice with the duties which follow from it. And to simply reduce the physician to a puppet with no professional responsibility to the profession, it seems to me, is just to prostitute what it is that we're at, that we are. Unless somebody out there can give me an argument as to why the medical community does not have a right to bind itself by duties like these, I don't know how, in the name of patient autonomy, you can run some sort of an argument that autonomy confers on patients the right to receive whatever treatment they want. I mean, anabolic steroids, if I'm a weightlifter, a CAT scan, very expensive, because I have mild occasional headaches. Oh, come on. Come on. The second reason why I think that patient autonomy doesn't confer on patients a right to receive any kind of medical treatment they want has to do with the fact that if we allow that, we may run afoul of another ethical principle, not at the heart of the medical profession, but just a general ethical principle called the principle of utility. Now, we've all been brought up from the crib. You've all heard, well, how would you know a utilitarian if you ran into one? What's the principle of utility? Well, I mean, we've heard it. Always pick that action among the group of alternatives with the fattest chance of generating the greatest good or the greatest number. I mean, we cut our teeth on this. Now, the principle of utility says that if you've got scarce medical resources, you don't want to waste them. Because wasting resources means that some person's overcare is probably tantamount to somebody else's undercare. You got it? I'm submitting that if I have very good reason to believe that a therapeutic medical procedure is not going to benefit a patient, then if that treatment is given, it's going to cost dollars, people. If the treatment is given, it's going to be a waste of medical resources, and under limited medical resources, that person's overcare, and I think rendering futile treatment is overcare, somebody else is going to take a hit. Somebody that could benefit by the limited medical funds is probably going to go without it. Okay? And you've hardly maximized the greatest good of the greatest number if you do that. But the third reason I would give as to why patients' autonomy rights do not confer on patients the right to demand and receive any care that they want has to do with the principle of justice. Look, one of the famous principles of justice is to each according to his need. It's a principle of justice. Now let's just go back to the situation we're talking about. If under scarce medical resources, somebody is rendered treatment which is futile, and we know this in advance, we have a waste of medical resources. And that's probably going to be tantamount to somebody not getting care for which they have a bona fide need and can benefit from. Somebody, mind you, who's not receiving according to his need, right? Nobody needs futile treatment, do they? And if somebody's parked out from getting treatment that they need, then you fudge the principle of justice. So I think that cumulatively there are three reasons as to why this vaunted patient autonomy does not confer on any patient the right to receive treatments which the and that physicians have both a right and indeed a duty to refuse this kind of treatment. I therefore rest my case, and at this point turn over. I understand there will be a brief rebuttal by Mr. Hobart Quimby, who represents the Society for Patients' Rights, so perhaps we could get Mr. Quimby to come in and
you can open it like that. Oh! do that? We've got so much music coming in, though, it'll make too much noise.
Well, we'll see. If it's too loud, we'll close it. Those are open.
Yeah. Good afternoon. My name is Hobart Quimby. I'm president of the Society for Patients' Rights, and I've been asked to issue a rejoinder to Dr. Dweek. Here's the main point I want to make. I insist that the proper party to decide whether the likely outcome of some treatment will be a significant benefit to the whole patient is the patient, him or herself. The proper concern of the physician, in my view, should be whether an available treatment serves the patient's goals. And I want to say that the futility of a therapeutic treatment cannot be unilaterally determined by the medical community itself without consultation with the patient. And I think that's Dweeby's problem, because he doesn't recognize this. I mean, look what Dweeby told you. He said, first of all, that he laid it down that a given treatment cannot benefit the patient as a whole if either of the two following conditions are met. Number one, if the patient is irreversibly unconscious and can't appreciate it. Number two, according to him, you can't be said in truth that a treatment can benefit a patient as a whole if the only kind of life the patient is likely to have after the treatment is one that's preoccupied, you know, with his illness, like he said. I'm telling you, people, these are really conservative criteria. I mean, they are really conservative, as they probably ought to be. But the problem here, in my view, is that their very conservativeness makes them minimally useful. I think borders on useless in addressing any of the real life complexity surrounding medically futile treatment. I mean, let me condition A. Treatment is going to be called futile if the patient can't appreciate it, and of course, if you're irreversibly unconscious, you can't appreciate it. Okay? If you're in a persistent vegetative state, irreversible coma, I ask you, of all the patients under the care of physicians as we speak, what percentage of those patients are in irreversible comas or persistent vegetative states? It really is a pittance of all the patients. I mean, so this criterion has a very limited range of applicability. I mean, let me tell you, I mean, this criterion of Dweeby's excludes the whole myriad of unsettled, and I think unsettling cases involving futile medical treatment of conscious patients who are in critical circumstances. I mean, this criterion doesn't help us a whit in deciding, should we give bone marrow transplants for breast cancer patients? Should we aggressively treat premature infants that weigh less than 500 grams? Should we give coronary bypass surgery for very old patients? Should we give CPR to patients with advanced cirrhosis? These are conscious patients, people. I mean, they're not unconscious. I mean, this is what we're wrestling with. And Dweeby's criterion just doesn't help us a whit. Now we got condition B. Remember he said that treatment is futile if the only kind of life it can deliver to a patient is to be a captive of an ICU unit or a life that's preoccupied with illness. But I'm telling you, look, how you would go about describing, I mean, just think of what the description would be of a life that is preoccupied with illness. I submit that the description would have to be so extreme that I can't imagine anything except a sadomasochistic patient requesting treatment under those conditions. Really, I don't. And this, it seems to me, raises question number one. I mean, it forces us to ask this question. Is a physician ever in a position to say, absent consultation with a patient, that the only the only benefit a given treatment will likely afford will be the continued capacity merely to superintend the ongoing management of his irreversible condition? I mean, look, suppose a physician concludes, on a basis of clinical evidence and so forth, that a given treatment, if rendered to a patient, will simply permit the patient to have a life that is consumed and preoccupied with his or her illness. And, you know, this is presumably a judgment that can be made unilaterally by a physician. I say baloney. I mean, let's consider what might really be the case, where you have a circumstance where a physician says, if this treatment goes forward, all the patient is going to have is going to be a perpetual captive of the ICU unit. The only life goal they're capable of achieving is one of just managing their condition. It could be, people, it could be, and you don't know this unless you ask the patient, it could still be that this patient we're talking about has been judged to have only, judged in the mind of the physician, to have only the possibility of a life that's consumed with their disease. Couldn't this be possible? Could we not have on our hands a patient whose religious beliefs emphasize the value of preserving life itself, period? Could we not be dealing with a patient that believes that life is everything and that aggressive treatment should be continued because God will work a miracle, if he will? I mean, that might be the nature of the patient. Does that give the patient something to live for beyond just superintending, right? Because they place an absolute value on life itself. They have religious qualms against taking their own life. Only God has given life, and only God has got the right to take life. It's really interesting to note in this regard, isn't it? Dweeby, look at him. What are his goals of medicine? Interesting, too. To assist nature to restore health, to relieve suffering. I would have thought that one of the tried and true goals of medicine was to preserve life. Real convenient for Dweeby to leave this out, isn't it? It makes his argument a lot powerful, you know, more powerful than I think it is. Isn't one of the goals of medicine to preserve life? He conveniently leaves it out. Let's go back to this patient, you know, that the doctor's judged, if the treatment goes forward, the only kind of life the person will have will be one that's consumed with his or her, preoccupied with illness. Could this not be also true of the patient? And I ask you, how would you know this, unless you ask the patient? Maybe this is a patient who desires to remain alive at all costs for a brief period of time until a loved one arrives, or to say goodbye, or to make amends. Could that possibly be? Does that give the patient a reason for living? Uh-huh, I think so. How would you ever know that unless you ask the patient? If either of these conditions fit the patient's circumstance, then I don't think it could be truthfully asserted that the only significant life goal the patient will be able to realize if the treatment is implemented will be to exercise continued supervision over the course of her degenerative life. I mean, it's false that that's the only thing that's left. But I'm telling you, without consulting a patient, you don't know. You don't know whether these other kinds of things are really there. So, here's where I'm going. The whole issue of whether the kind of post-treatment life the patient might have, the whole issue of whether that's a worthwhile one, whether it's the kind of life that's worth maintaining by medicine, logically cannot be decided without consulting the patient. Now, this is obviously a valuational issue about which patients and physicians may differ, and they probably will. But I'm asking you, if these differences arise, surely it's the patient's judgment that takes precedence, isn't it? Who is better able to speak as to whether such and such predicted quality of life is worth living except the patient? Isn't it patient's call? I would think so, unless you can give me some sort of an argument as to how a patient could be wrong. I don't know what that argument would be like. But now I'm heading into the home stretch of my rebuttal to Dweeby. Here's my claim. I want to say that an unacceptable quality of life is one which the individual patient judges to be worse than death. Want me to repeat it? An unacceptable life is one which the individual patient judges to be worse than death. It follows that the proper party to decide whether the likely outcome of some treatment will be of significant benefit to the patient is the patient. The patient. I mean, the medical community doesn't have any, what, special expertise in judging what kind of life is worth living, do they? I mean, it is appropriately the patient's prerogative. So it follows, in my view, that the proper concern of a physician should be whether an available therapeutic treatment serves the patient's goals. To reject this claim, in my view, is to return to an outmoded form of medical paternalism. I have one last zinger. I think we need to ponder the following point. Isn't it worth noting that telling a patient that there's no hope may not itself be an action that benefits the patient? Dweeby, are you listening? You're talking about benefiting patients? I'm telling you that telling a patient that there's no hope may not itself be an action that benefits the patient. There's sizable evidence that hope is therapeutic. Therefore, doctors should foster it rather than diminish it. If a doctor removes hope, his futility pronouncement can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. A patient who accepts that there's no hope may do worse than a patient with hope. So if hope is therapeutic, there is no such thing as false hope for a competent patient. Hence, it's never therapeutically justified for a physician to tell a patient that the situation is hopeless. I thus think that the case you heard from my eminent colleague is utterly worthless, and rest my case. Well, enough said.
I have to hurt your head.
Yeah, let me get out of this. You have any reactions to this debate? This is serious. I mean, this is the debate going on. And I don't think either side, the argument on either side, you know, you can say, oh, that just has the weight of thistle down. Uh-uh. I mean, these are bona fide arguments. Yeah.
You had mentioned somebody making the decision. If I'm
a surrogate,
and I said he's to make the decisions for me, but he's got a guilty conscience, and geez, if he says, pull the plug or don't,
right,
then he's going to have that guilt eating away. So he says, do anything and everything, just I don't care what you do, but keep her alive.
And this goes on all the time, doesn't it?
Of course it does.
I mean, at the hospital that I worked for a while, physicians gave me these horror stories, and you may have been part of these. Somebody lying in bed, they're irreversibly unconscious or something, and they've never made out a living will. Nobody's got a clue, you know, as to what their wishes would be in these circumstances. And so the physician gathers, you know, the immediate family in the ante room to the ICU unit and talk about what we should do and so forth. We don't know what the patient wants. So let's consult. Now, oftentimes physicians tell me the immediate family, the ones that live day by day, small number, you know, they decided, I don't think that dad would really want this, or I don't think it's in dad's best interest to do this, and so, you know, let's back off from ventilator or something of the sort. Oftentimes, that's what you're talking about. The guy's got a sister from which she's been alienated for 15 years. She flies in from Seattle. She's got a bad case of the guilt. She walks in. She's now sitting with a family. She's a domineering kind of a person. Okay. The doctor comes in and says, well, what does the family want to do? And she says, we want everything done. Well, the other members of the family just sort of, you know, back down and so forth. Well, we got the family's judgment, right? I mean, this is what physicians say happens all the time. That's why we should all make out little cards which identifies who authoritatively speaks for us. But we want everything done, right? And it doesn't matter what a doc says is futile. Now the question is, can he be bulldozed? I mean, is the family's call? Really? Is that the kind of power we want to franchise on it?
Then I want to go up on another tactic. I'm a hospice volunteer. In our community, it is the law that if a hospice patient, let's say, has died, the family panics, dials 911, The ambulance is set. The EMTs must, by law, resuscitate. When, you know, after having gone
if they've been called, the presumption is that we are care renderers, and that's what we're here for.
That's
and
right.
We're going to render care.
Yes.
Can I just ask you, I love that as a stepping stone here. Here's some of the issues which the hospital I work at is going to end up considering as ways of the medical community, inclusive of hospitals and doctors, taking a proactive stance in trying to get built into policies things relevant to this feudal care thing. How about this? Let's just start with nursing homes, okay? Right now, the way things are is that if somebody enters a nursing home, the assumption is if the person needs CPR, that they will be rendered cardiopulmonary resuscitation unless, you see, some do not resuscitate order has been agreed to, hopefully by the patient, if he or she is, you know, competent and so forth. But the presumption is you render the treatment unless the treatment has been denied by the patient. What about if nursing homes adopted this? If you have a demented patient who upon entry into the nursing home, the considered judgment is made, this person is never going to leave. I mean, they will never leave. This is their last residence. They're demented. Suppose a nursing home told the public that under those conditions, if the person required CPR, we're not going to give it. That's just, I'm telling you, this is what we're going to do. We're not going to do it.
Why would they tell the public?
Huh?
Why would they tell the public? Isn't that a direct family matter?
So it's sort of like an institutional advance directive. Everybody knows, everybody knows that this is the way we're going to proceed. Let me go back to your paramedics. Suppose we had a policy change internal to paramedic things, which simply said that if the paramedics determine that somebody's dead when they show up, that they don't rush into a hospital in order to be hooked up to further life support apparatus. They're declared dead on the scene and then take. Want to crank it up? How about a hospital policy which is worded like this? That if you enter an intensive care unit and a considered judgment is made that you will never leave it, okay? You're never going to get out of it. You're that hopeless. Then the hospital will give you, I don't know, pick a number of days. I don't know, 45 days or something that they're going to take care of you in the ICU. And then after that, you're out. Now, if you personally, out of pocket, want to pay for continued, allegedly futile ICU care, then fine, we'll keep you in there. But we're not going to draw down on your insurance or Medicare or something. Wouldn't this be an interesting policy? I mean, it's not, you know, we're simply going to say, after this period of time has elapsed, we're going to do everything possible. But if it comes to the point, I mean, there's some clinical judgment to be made that nothing's going to happen here. I mean, what are we going to do? Be a prisoner of this person? And we just keep on and on and on and on, and dollars keep cranking out? Suppose we just publish the policy. You know, after 45 days, if we think we're in the business of giving futile care, we're not going to do it anymore. Now, if you want to pay for it out of pocket, fine. But that's not what we're going to do.
But you're shifting the argument then from ethics to money, right? Mm-hmm.
I know, but the hospital is trying to develop a policy for dealing with this.
No, okay.
Let's go for managed care groups like HMOs, mm-hmm. which typically have both an insuring side. I mean, they're insure, but they also conscript clinics and hospitals and so forth to render the care. And they usually got a double side to this. Suppose a managed care corporation had two kind of policies, and it's then you can choose what kind of policy. I mean, policy A simply says that, you know, if you're under hospital conditions and you're clinically judged, you know, that there's nothing to do to help you, that we will bankroll out of the pool of funds X number of days or something for care for you. But after that, we don't do it anymore. Okay? Now, that's one kind of policy, and that's the cheap one. Or, if you want the Mercedes-Benz policy, you could buy a policy
in which even though the medical community judges that the treatment's going to be futile, we go on giving it to you, but you got to pay more for that policy. But you got to choose now, before you get in the circumstance, as to what you want to do with your money. I mean, you can have a Mercedes-Benz, but if you want to be rendered futile medical care, then you pay. And if you don't, you go for the Slim Jim policy. Would these be bad moves? Would these be bad? You see the whole point? It's trying to build into the very policies of medical institutions stuff having to do with futile medical treatment. Informing the public right up front, this is the way we proceed. Now, if you want somebody with more liberal policies, then look around. But this is the way we proceed. These are the in-house rules. I mean, is this cruel?
I don't know, but isn't that the way managed care is going?
I don't know of any managed care outfit. Let me just give an example. I know of not one managed care or health insurance thing that says, look, we'll offer two policies, and one of the provisions of policy A, which is the Slim Jim policy, it's the least costly, is that if you go into a persistent vegetative state, okay, and you're judging you're never going to come out of it, and if the facts are, if you are in a persistent vegetative state for 2 weeks, there's less than a 5% probability of you ever coming out of it. I mean, that's the facts, 95% lose it. Now, suppose an insurer wrote an insurance product that simply says, okay, among other provisions, we're only going to pay for, I mean, once you're judged in a persistent vegetative state, we won't give you just 2 weeks, we'll give you a month at our expense. And then we quit paying. Okay? Now, on the other hand, if you want to continue to be hooked up to this like Karen Ann Quinlan, okay, fine. But you pay. You pay for this. This is cruel. I don't know of any insurance company that offers policies like that. They're talking about it. They're talking about it.
Just at lower levels of treatment, I think.
Right. But you decide.
Yeah.
That 95% losing average is not worth my paying this extra amount of money. But notice who's making the decision. It's thrown back on you. I mean, it's not made for you, you end up making it. Yes?
Okay, what about an insurance policy cap $1 million? When they hit the $1 million, boom, is that over with? No. Boom. Cancer treatments.
Well, isn't that the way it is now?
Organ, oh yeah. But there are some that have an unlimited amount. But look at an organ donor. I mean, a person awaiting a transplant. Let's take Mickey Mantle. There was money. Did he or did he not cause
somebody else to be bumped? Yeah, yeah. We don't. I don't think so. Everything I read about it, I think that was a clean judgment by the United Network for Organ Sharing. I mean, it was a strict priority criteria. I mean, they didn't kowtow to his money.
But now they're saying that if you caused through alcohol or drugs
your own cirrhosis of the liver and you need a liver transplant, it's not just so you're parked out forever, it's just you get way down the list. Everybody else is higher up than you are.
Right.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Self-wrought?
I think so.
I think I had to go through this decision with my own father just about three or four months ago in March. But my father had made this decision while he was still conscious and very mentally capable, but he had made the wishes known to the family that in any case he gets vegetative to the point, just make him comfortable and let him go. But he made his wishes known to the rest of his family.
Right.
And we knew the situation and it resolved, it answered a lot of the problems that the family has to make. And if you can talk to the person that is in an elderly state, so they know what the wishes are, family does, then it resolves a lot of this.
You're right. And the hospital system that our little hospital in River Falls is under, big holding company, they have lots of hospitals and so forth. The interesting thing about it is that in their last pronouncement, I mean, they sent word to all.
I'm just going to give you a time.
Okay. They sent word to all of the institutions under their wing, you know, whether it's nursing homes or whatever, sent news that they really want to
publicized that Allina Health Systems, which is the name of something, they really want to publicize the fact that Allina wants to make what is called palliative care a medical specialty, and to apprise people of they first of all want to find out what is the nature of adequate, really good palliative care, that's comfort care. What are the indices of that? And they want, as a corporation, to be able to supply that to their people. And one of the things, of course, that they're wrestling with here is whether whatever needs, I mean, if we do ratchet down in a given patient, so we say no more aggressive treatment, it's hopeless, and we're just going out for comfort care, how could they adequately provide good comfort care under the policies which people have? And this is a point at which a movement which is relatively new to me, called the hospice movement, I think has got an awful lot to be able to start to say to the Allina Health Systems. Anybody here had any dealings with hospice?
You do.
You know, Nancy has. You want to tell us a little bit about what that program is?
Okay, hospice is a program where a physician certifies, says that a patient has 6 months or less to live, that further chemo or radiation or heroic measures are not appropriate because the patient is terminal in 6 months or less. So they come on a hospice program, and the goals of hospice are quality of life. They work with the patient and the family.
Usually in a home?
In the home situation.
I mean, where the patient...
Wherever it's possible.
Yeah, but usually patients would rather die at home, I would, rather than an institution,
right.
So that's...
And the hospice team consists of hospice nurses, social worker, there's a chaplain if the person wishes to have discussions with a chaplain, and there are volunteers who go in to the home to provide support and relief for the primary caregivers, so that they're there through the hospice team to, number one, provide quality of life. That includes
pain management is job one.
Yes, absolutely.
And my understanding from people I talk to in hospice is that unlike in hospital situations where doc has written the chart simply saying that, you know, Nancy should get 2 tablets doled out every 4 hours, and then you feel uncomfortable at the end of 2 hours, and then you get on the bell, and the nurse says, but Dr. Blatt said that you can't have this, you know, you're a bad patient. I mean, doesn't hospice simply say on demand?
Yes.
They're not worried about you getting addicted, because
right.
You're dying. I mean, who cares about this anymore?
Comfort is the...
One of the most important things we raised our funds for, we just finished a big fundraiser 3 weeks ago. So 3 weeks ago today. We raised $11,000. A lot of the money is going into what they call CAD funds. I'm not sure what the term means, but it's a self-administering pain relief. So it's continuous, and anytime.
Oh, so you administer your own?
Yes.
Wow.
We now have 3 or 4 of these where we can give them to the patients,
and whenever they feel uncomfortable, they can
push a button and relieve his or her own care, a pain, and it has made a significant difference in a lot of the patients.
You know what people have told me, I think this is really interesting with all the hubbub about Jack Kevorkian and physician-assisted suicide. Hospice people have told me about their experiences. Mm-hmm. If a patient comes under care of hospice, they're told up front, we will not abandon you. Your comfort is job one, and we're going to keep you comfortable. We're going to keep metering the amount of painkilling drugs to keep you, you know, conscious as long as we can, but comfortable. And we're here for you, and we're never going to let you go. And patients under those circumstances lose all interest and call him Dr. Jack. They really do. I don't care about that anymore. I mean, this is amazing, because if we developed a policy like this, it'd probably pull the rug from underneath the whole let's legalize physician-assisted suicide, because the brute fact is, if I can be guaranteed that I'm comfortable, I lose interest.
That's what they did with my dad, made sure he was comfortable. A hospice nurse came in. She determined that he was not getting enough pain medicine. She called the hospital, got the medication. She made sure it was administered to him to make him comfortable. Mm-hmm. And then he passed away in relatively comfort.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the point that my hospital corporation is wrestling with. They wager, this is a wager, they wager that if people have the confidence that under Alina Health Systems, they're going to get top-notch comfort care of the sort that hospice promises to deliver, that we're probably going to have fewer fights between patients and physicians demanding this kind of futile care, that the motivation for these confrontations is going to lower.
One of the interesting things that has transpired, we've been in hospice, what, about 4 or 5 years now, but at the beginning stages, we were detecting that many of the hospital nurses, four nurses, and a number of the physicians did not understand the job of hospice was to help a person comfortably through the dying process, that they were healers. And the doctors, the physicians, and the nurses would say, we have to keep this patient alive. This is why the doctor was talking about the futile care and fighting for that. But this is, it was interesting to see the transition in the physicians, seeing that, yeah, this patient is going to die. So that we're not fighting to keep that patient alive, we're fighting to keep that patient comfortable.
And is this a change up somewhat in the standard understanding of my reason for being as a physician as you get out of med school? I'm here to keep biological life going. And man, when a patient dies, I failed.
Yes.
No. We need to wean them from that, don't we?
Hospice is the opposite. We have to train the doctors sometimes and the regular floor nurses in this transition to it's okay, this person is going to die, you can't do anything about it, let's keep that patient calm.
A lot of times they'll wait until, say, the last week of a patient's life and then say, they've got 6 months or less, put them on. And that's not enough time to give quality.
Right.
So the sooner a person can go on the hospice,
thanks for coming,
the more benefits they receive from it.
Thank you.
And my understanding also of hospice, I'm just a beginner here, is the hospice thinks that some valuable things can transpire in the relationship between dying patient and family.
Absolutely.
Conversations that we put off for years that are about the big issues. And if you're asking, is there a reason for staying alive? Yes. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can have closure here. And
there's a wonderful book, and I think I'm not sure that they have any more over in the bookstore, called Final Gifts. It's written by a couple hospice nurses. And I found it here at Holden 3 years ago, read it on the way home, told him he had to read it, and he said, wow. And we have donated many of these books to...
What's that?
Final gift.
Isn't that interesting that Derek Humphrey, the president of the Hemlock Society, his book, which was for 20 weeks on the bestseller nonfiction list, called, what, Final Exit? Remember that? The book was Final Exit. What it was a how to kill yourself without blowing it manual. I mean, it was a step-by-step suicide manual, and it just was an incredible bestseller.
But this
Final Gift is a really interesting...
Final Gifts is in a little paperback book. It costs $5.99, but it's well worth every penny. It takes several different patients and their process and how you can listen and gain so much. So it's a marvelous little book.
Can I make a point about what you're talking about with hospitals? I think it's really wonderful that that movement has helped all healthcare providers shift their attention to really providing comfort. But what I've heard mentioned here is this acceptance that a person who will have life at the end of their illness, it's okay for them to be uncomfortable. And I think the same kinds of narcotic administration should be occurring with even patients who expect to go home in a week or so. And narcotics are grossly underprescribed.
It's very interesting because I was at a workshop where it was stated that a person who is non-terminal but in excruciating pain, if they have enough of the pain medication to make them comfortable, there's not going to be an addiction problem.
Yeah, why should it kick in just for a terminal condition?
Right, exactly.
Right.
And it's brutal.
Absolutely.
But this is new in the literature, and it's really just coming out now, so I think that all of you also have a role to go to your physicians and say, it's not okay for me to be in pain for the last 2 hours of my little regimen here.
There's also a trend in nursing homes and in hospitals toward the TCU, or the transitional care unit, where a person might go into a nursing home to get good care, but they know that patient's coming out.
And going home.
We are going to be breaking ground for a hospice wing on our hospital in another month or two, and we will have a couple of transitional care units or rooms in the hospice, just temporarily until the hospice until we have enough to fill up the rooms. But there's a transitional care emphasis now for that type of thing, knowing that these people are not in the hospital under intensive care or anything like this. They are going to get out and they're going through transition with all kinds of therapy.
Rehab.
Physical therapy, rehabilitation therapy, occupational therapy, all of this type of thing. And these are wonderful too.
You know, what is interesting, one of the ideas which has been percolated here with the Ohio Health Systems, think about this. I mean, I think this is a relatively new idea for the medical community. But the argument is that all hospitals within the Ohio system should make, should have pain and what the patient says about her level of pain become a fifth vital sign that has to be monitored on the chart, along with blood pressure, along with temperature. What are the other two? The doctor has to inquire and get an answer. How are you? How are you feeling? Are you comfortable? And then the chart can be monitored to say, well, if there's no improvement in this patient's comfort condition, why isn't there? Who's flubbing the dub here? I mean, we won't be able to monitor this to be able to call these people to account if they're not in pain management.
Pain that's out of control does so much damage to the human body. It increases the blood pressure and does, all these other things. So that with the pain under control, the healing comes along much faster.
How many patients are there that have uncontrollable pain, regardless of treatment?
Wait a minute. Do you mean actually uncontrolled pain or theoretically uncontrolled pain? Because the hospice movement says there is no such thing as the latter.
Well, in 1997, there is. I don't know. I don't know how to break it down that much. But I do have some clients, that are quadriplegics that have continuous pain. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be intractable. And I'm just wondering. I don't want to focus on them, but just. I'd like to know what some of the realities are, if you folks know.
I don't know the number, but I do think that is a valid subset of people, despite extensive medication, mm-hmm. trying all sorts of different products, who still do have intractable pain. So I don't think it's just under medication.
There really is such a thing as cases of truly unmitigatable pain.
Right, right.
I was already under the impression that if you ask anesthetist or something, somebody trained in this, that he or she would simply say there's no such thing. We can always up the ante. Mm-hmm. We can always keep them comfortable. Maybe we'll get to the point where in order to keep them comfortable, we have to put them in a la-la land. In which case, now what?
Unless there's physical healing that's taking place while the patient is anesthetized, that will ultimately lead the patient to a a quality, more quality life. That's a hard judgment.
Doesn't it behoove us as individuals, as we are getting older, to make our wishes known,
yes,
to our families, to eliminate some of these problems, if they know that...
I can't agree more, and I think what we're wrestling with is whether us fledgling senior citizens ought to exercise muscle on the outfits that give us care to change their policies. To change their policies concerning the rendering of care, to provide us with these sorts of things, and to say, we're going to pay for it. We're going to pay for it. This is under your policy. I mean, right now, this is what we need to do.
Well, I'm trying to make it clear to my children what I want,
but
or don't want.
Not only to your children, make sure that your pastor, your doctor.
And have a talk with the funeral director.
Yes. We have
we have
a system in
Portland
that is very worthwhile.
Are we at the bewitching hour?
It's a good discussion.
Man cannot live by philosophy.
No.
Zion
has written a book.
I know him. I talked with him about 3 weeks ago out in Montana.
See, he's in Missoula.
Yes, in Missoula. And he's the main man.
Yeah.
And
he's 50 miles away from us.
Well, I don't know what you guys are doing right, but I mean, really, he's the guru. I mean, he's the spokesperson.
And have you heard of the Chalice of Repose? That's also out of Missoula.
That's the result.
Well, I know, there's something called the Missoula Demonstration Project.
They have $1,000. They have the Chalice of Repose, they have Biop, they have, you know.
Right.
And we're fortunate to be 50 miles away from there.
Well, that's where it's happening. I mean, you guys are...
Which is amazing. For here we are, living in Dickey, little Hamilton, Montana, in the middle of nowhere, and we sound like we're at the cutting edge of
it. You are.
Which is amazing. I don't know.
And talking about the meeting, that was a gentleman. In fact, he was our first one.